under the heading Privatization in the Oil Sector, he continued. Needless to say, this will be a very contentious issue within the ministry, the government, and the population at large. He argued against a precipitous sale of stock in Iraqi oil enterprises, a trust fund for Iraqis, along the lines of the Alaskan model, whereby regular cash royalties were paid to qualified citizens, would be preferable. He also suggested that it would be in the U.S. interest to develop an educational program for employees in Iraq's oil ministry, specifically comers who could be trained in the United States. Such a program would not only meet the ministry's needs, but would begin to build a group of future leaders who would have a taste of U.S. life. Carroll's memo accurately forecasted the Bush administration's oil policy in post-war Iraq. The policy was constructed to protect Iraqi decision-making prerogatives, but also to account for enduring American interests, including those of U.S.-headquartered oil corporations. As Iraq's anti-American insurgency intensified after 2004, the Iraqi state's capacity to manage its own affairs gradually weakened. Iraq's potential to oversee oil production on its own, which would have been challenging in any circumstance, gradually became all but impossible. International capital and private oil companies would be required to rescue Iraq's position whenever the internal violence generated by the American invasion calmed. As Tariq Shafiq had observed about the First World War, access by Western companies to Iraq's oil did not need to be an explicit cause of the Bush administration's invasion to become an outcome. Douglas Feith had been thinking about global oil security issues since the first term of the Reagan administration, when he worked on energy policy as a young staffer at the National Security Council. He considered himself something of a contrarian on the subject. After the oil shocks and embargoes of the 1970s, it was common in Washington to think of energy security as a problem in which newly powerful Arab exporters could wield the oil weapon over supplicant Western importers. This was the political science model of oil security, as Feith put it. Oil supplies lay scattered around the globe, as on the board of a risk game, and governments competed for advantage and control. The United States military developed contingent plans to seize oil fields in Saudi Arabia in an emergency, particularly if the Soviet Union moved against them. Hostile governments might squeeze the United States by withholding its oil, as the Saudis and other Arab producers had done over American policy toward Israel. A logical response to this embargo threat was the one taken by President Gerald Ford in late 1975, when he signed into law a bill that authorized, among other things, the construction of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, where the United States could store volumes of oil equivalent to several months of imports, to be released in the event of an embargo or supply disruption. The SPR, as it was known, provided the United States with a countermove against hostile oil producers in the game of physical access. The reserve's existence presumably deterred oil-producing enemies from imposing embargoes. If one was imposed anyway, the SPR provided Washington with time to pursue military or other interventions against the aggressor. Feith concluded that this way of conceptualizing oil security was misguided. He was a young free market thinker, and he noted that neither economists nor oil industry executives saw the global oil market the way political scientists or naval blockade strategists did. In the economists' view, oil was a commodity just like any other commodity. As was true for cocoa or coffee, there was a single global market for oil. There were gradations of price for different types of oil quality, but fundamentally, oil's global price went up or down on the basis of worldwide supply and demand. The best way to visualize the market was to think of a global bathtub or pool of oil, with spigots pouring into it from many different exporting countries and customers piping out supplies where they required them. Traders and speculators set the price of a new barrel of Iraqi or Russian or Chadian crude in Rotterdam's spot market or on futures exchanges in London, New York, and Chicago. In such a system, no single oil producer could disrupt supplies or control prices very effectively for long, Feith believed. A major producer like Saudi Arabia or the OPEC cartel could attempt to withhold supplies, and by doing so prop up prices temporarily, or try to punish a particular importer, but the forces of economic gravity in the pooled global market were likely to prevail over time. When global prices rose, as they did during the 1970s, the incentives to invest in new oil production also increased, and so new supply came online, which in turn reduced global prices again, exactly as occurred during the 1980s when Feith worked at Reagan's NSC. He noted that the collapse in the price of oil during the 1980s was precisely the opposite of what many political analysts inside the United States government had predicted. President Jimmy Carter's 1977 National Energy Program presumed that oil would become very scarce and very expensive in the 1980s. In 1979, the Central Intelligence Agency forecasted, "The world can no longer count on increases in oil production to meet its energy needs." Why were they wrong? Feith thought he knew the answer. The history of commodities was one of prices going up, supplies increasing, and prices falling back down again. Oil, fundamentally, was no different. The timelines required to bring new supplies online were longer than, say, the planting of corn crops, but the underlying economic pattern was the same. One implication of this analysis was that the geographical origins of a particular barrel of oil did not matter very much. Except for the issues of a particular barrel's quality, that is, the ease with which it could be refined, and transportation costs, global oil traders did not care whether a new barrel poured from a spigot in the Middle East, Latin America, Australia, or Africa. As it happened, half or more of global oil reserves lay in the Middle East, so that region's political stability and transport lanes would always command attention. However, in an economic sense, the Middle East's barrels were the same as all others. Feith's views were reinforced by what happened in international oil markets after Islamic radicals seized power in Iran in 1979. Carter imposed a boycott on Iranian imports, but Iranian oil just found its way to European and other international traders. Those traders often resold Iranian oil on the spot markets. Other producers who had previously sold to Europeans now sold to American companies. Global supplies and prices proved to be resilient. Companies, not governments, decided where particular batches of oil were shipped for refining, on the basis of price, transport, and technical factors.